Welcome to Bad Patient, Malpractice Makes Perfect. I'm Robin Donovan.
And I'm Laura Marker.
And we are two non-medical, non-experts sifting through this week's health news.
And this week's words are cold or flu, insulin, rare illness, and make-a-wish.
Make-a-wish. Wait, Laura, before we get started, I need to tell you about a special circumstance that's happening on my end.
Okay.
So, just so you know, this is a total Portland brag. I'm telling you this story so you can know how cool our lives are or something. All right. So be ready to praise me. But so I have a friend who's bringing over some live crab that he caught on the coast today. And so just in case we have to take a little break, I'm going to be receiving some live crabs in my kitchen. And one of the questions,
so you got crabs?
What?
You got crabs?
I don't want to.
You're about to get crabs?
I don't want to phrase it that way, but technically, yes. I feel like when I run for president, someone's going to misquote me on that, right? But this is my question about crabs for you, not the illness, the animal.
Okay.
So if he brings them over, like, is there a way that I can, like, store them? Because, I mean, obviously I'm not going to, like, cook them immediately. And so, and I perchance want to go to, like, a bike session tonight. So, like, can I put the crabs, like, in a pan and put the lid on? Are they going to be, like, scrabbling around in there? I think they're going to scrabble.
They're going to scrabble around in there. They're live crabs.
Maybe I just have to cook them really fast. And then, but then it's like you want to eat them fresh. You don't want to eat them. This is a conundrum.
Isn't that the whole point of having live? I mean,
I guess. I mean,
I don't. Can't they, I don't know.
Can they? Maybe they can. Can they hang out like in the freezer or something? Like,
then they're not like fresh live crabs.
And I don't want to torture them. And I already have very mixed feelings about killing them. All right. Well, I think this is a good time for us to tell our listeners how to contact us. Listeners, we need your help and support. Now more than ever, you can email us at hello@thebadpatient.com with story ideas, health questions, comments, concerns, or, very urgently, information about what to do with a bunch of live crabs. You can also tweet us at @thebadpatient. You can visit our website at thebadpatient.com, and there is no way through the website to tell me how to deal with crabs. Okay? So, but if anyone could let us know about the crabs, I think my friend's going to be here, call it an hour. So, you know, just like,
okay,
heads up sees on that. All right.
I appreciate the heads up. That was a genuine heads up.
Yeah,
you were going to say that, Robin.
I
know where you're going with it. Crabs is not, I'm going to be honest, I was never going to guess crabs. So
that's what I'm saying.
You win.
That's what I'm saying. # my West Coast life. No, it's so obnoxious sometimes. It's just one of those things. I was going to tell you before we started recording, and I was like, it would be so much more fun if everyone could know that I am awaiting a small number of crabs because said friend caught too many crabs. Now there are extra crabs. Now I can have crabs. But I did not consider the storage issues until very, very recently. I just, you know, like someone's like, do you want some crab? And you say yes to that because you're living your best life. And that's a thing. See?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, I also have another idea. Instead of asking you for three current events at the end, what if we put that at the beginning? Because we want to give people a chance to, like, learn about those things before they consider the health news. Do you think that's a good idea?
Sure.
Do you have some current events that you want us to know about?
No, I hadn't thought about that, Robin.
All right.
Coming. To be honest, normally that's something I think about during the podcast.
We'll ask you at the end.
Well, I think, like, it's probably, okay, I do have it. So my sister and I have gotten super involved with a political organization. So get a little politicky.
Okay.
The group is called Mothers Demand Actions Against Gun Violence in America. So, you know, it just rolls right off the tongue.
It does. It's short.
And it's a group that looks at common sense laws. So it's kind of modeled, it is purposely modeled after, not kind of, purposely modeled off of Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Okay.
And then the same way of, like, not taking away liquor, but reducing the deaths of alcohol-caused death. Mama Samantha Action also wants to reduce gun violence deaths.
Okay.
So it's looking at not taking away guns, but what we can do to have some common sense laws and regulations and enforcing the laws that we have. Sure. So they support, like, you know, red flag laws and bans on different types of guns.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, I get a lot of news feeds about gun violence. And recently, the medical associations have put out information about gun violence and how to reduce gun violence with doctors. And the NRA responded, I don't know if you saw this, with telling doctors to stay in their lane.
Yep, saw it.
And that they didn't have anything to do with gun violence, and that has responded with trauma doctors responding with pictures of themselves or of the aftermath of, like, the operating room of why it is their lane for gun violence, because they are the ones that are trying to save people's lives.
And it's chilling. It gun is violence chilling. Has happened. Like, have you looked at those? I'm sure you have. The hashtag is "This is my lane," right? This is my lane is the
right. Yeah,
I mean, and it's so some people posted some pretty bloody stuff, and it's not people. They never show the patients. Obviously, that would be a HIPAA violation, but they do show. They, like, one person took a picture of himself from the knees down, and he's covered. And I understand, like, that's a thing that happens in medical situations anyway. But then they'll say, like, you know, this kid didn't make it. And it's really shocking and horrifying.
Right. So it's a different view. And with the most recent election, we were working on getting Gun Sense candidates on the ballot and then trying to work to get them elected.
Okay.
I understand that it's a controversial issue, and I am a strong believer of the Second Amendment, but I'm also a strong believer of with rights come responsibilities, and gun owners have a responsibility to ensure that guns are properly stored to prevent accidental deaths.
Yeah.
And also, there are 96 Americans that are killed every day due to gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman is more likely to die if there is domestic violence in the home and a gun.
True.
And I understand that guns kill people. People kill people, not guns kill people. But people with guns are much more effective at it.
Yes.
And I think that there is an epidemic
of
gun violence in America. And I think there are things that we can do to reduce it without taking away anybody's gun.
Yeah, I think there is a middle ground.
Spoilers, I'm a little liberal.
We hadn't noticed. No, I mean, I think there's a middle ground. You know, I'm not going to express, like, my personal feelings because I feel like I'm not as informed on politics as I am on health. But from a health perspective, I think that guns are certainly a public health issue, and mm-hmm. we can't separate those things. You know, it would be nice if we could, but we have to let,
of the matter is,
we can't.
We do have an epidemic, and we are disproportionately, as Americans,
affected,
more likely to die of gun violence than any other peer country in the developed world.
Yeah, so, and I mean, there was the Chicago shooting was today, right? As we're recording this, it's November 21st, and a female physician in Chicago was shot and killed by her romantic partner, who she had, they were in the process of breaking up, or she had told him she didn't want any more contact. And, you know, I mean, we make a lot of jokes about online dating and my group of friends, but the truth is that things like this are not that uncommon. Unfortunately, the male rage is not as uncommon as people would think. And if you're listening to this and you love me, don't worry. No one has, like, threatened my life or anything, but it's such an aspect of our culture, you know? And I don't, I just, you don't hear about as many women shooting things up. And I don't know. I think it's time for some conversations. You know, we make all these jokes like on a first date, the guy is afraid that the woman is not going to be as attractive as she appears in her photos. And the woman is afraid that the guy is going to kill her. You know, like top concerns of men and women. Those are the actual concerns. You know, like we're hoping for a romantic spark first, but the first thing that we're thinking about is how do I stay safe? Where is a public place that I can meet this person? Are they like giving off the right vibes? Like, where am I going to park? What would I do if he didn't seem safe? Well, let me text my friend before I go in. Like, it's very, you know. It's very sobering. I'm not sure why I made this about online dating. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Okay. This is our longest intro ever. Maybe our best intro ever. Do we want to get into stories?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the first story comes from BuzzFeed News. It's about how to tell if your symptoms are the flu or just a cold.
Oh, so no, you over... did not. Did you just know this was going to make me mad? We've talked about this. Oh, this is. I don't even need to see this story. I know. I have this information. I'm very unhappily clicking on this link. This is so dumb. Also, I wrote this story. I literally wrote this story, okay? Like, years ago, and it wasn't new then either. All right, I'm taking a deep breath. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Caroline Key wrote this. And it's totally new. It's from the 15th. So
literally everyone seems to be getting sick. That's the first line.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So contrary to popular belief, cold weather does not make you sick, but respiratory viruses, namely influenza, do tend to peak during the fall and winter. Flu season is typically in the U.S. is from October to March. And so it's just kind of looking at the common cold versus the flu, what the differences are, and they talk to a doctor about it. They also have a note, and I would like to read it because it also applies to this podcast and always. Note, this article is for informational purposes only and not a substitute for medical advice. Yes. If you have questions or concerns about your personal health, talk to a healthcare provider. I feel like that should be like just like assumed for all things.
I know. I kind of thought that was assumed, but you know, one of these days someone's going to send an angry email. And if you want to send an angry email, hello@thebadpatient.com. Can you tell we want emails? Send us an email, especially if it's about crabs. Those crabs are still on their way, okay? You may have forgotten, but I have not. Okay. This is not medical advice, but like, just, okay. First of all, Laura, did you get your flu shot?
Yes, I did.
I'm very impressed. Okay. Obviously, I got mine.
I know, you should be.
Can I go over the reasons that you should get a flu shot? Even though I go over them every single year.
Absolutely.
Do you like how I say every Absolutely. Single year, like this is a 10-year-old podcast? Okay. reason number one, check your sources, people. It is safe. But that's not even a reason. That's not even a reason. But just know that it's more safe than anything else. Like, it's way more safe than taking an aspirin. It's very, 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 very safe. Very safe. Okay. Okay, so the first reason is that you can't always tell the difference between a cold and a flu. So if you're not getting the flu shot because you think you never get the flu, the chances are that you do sometimes get it, and you might just think like it's a bad cold. So a bad cold and a mild flu can appear the same, and vice versa. So people that are like, I just don't ever get a cold, or I don't get the flu, so I don't need the flu shot. That's reason number one. Reason number two, you could be someone who is carrying a virus that you can spread, as far as I understand, that like maybe you have very, very light symptoms or mild symptoms, but you could still give that virus to someone else who perhaps has no immune system, who perhaps cannot get the flu shot for any one of a number of health reasons. So you can still pass around a flu virus without realizing that you have it. You don't need to like go to the doctor and they say like, yep, it's the flu. Like if you have a flu virus, you can be contagious regardless of whether or not you realize that you have it. So it's good for you, it's good for the community, and then also, you know, hitting again on this point of susceptible people, and I think just from, like, hospice volunteering, I sometimes hear people say really insensitive things like, well, you know, like these really old people, like, what does it matter? You know, like kind of what does it matter? And I'm telling you that if you are 9 years old and dying, 19 years old and dying, or 90 years old and dying, everyone wants more time. So it does, to me, it does matter. And that I think we should try as hard as we can, or I'm trying as hard as I can, if I get sick, to stay away from people, because what's a normal illness for you could be like life or death for someone else. So those are my three reasons to get a flu shot. Three plus the one where nothing bad is going to happen to you. So I don't know, but like, I never convince anyone. I think last year I actually did convince a few people, but you know, I don't know. I've actually kind of gotten away from wanting to convince people, but I just feel like this information is out there and we should know it. So if you hear the information and you want to double check me, by all means, please do double check. Please talk to your doctor about it. Maybe some new research will come out and we'll find that it's not as great. I don't know. But for now, I think those are the facts that I know about flu shots, and I wish that people would consider them in their decision, as opposed to like, I don't feel like, I don't know if it's going to make a difference, you know? Like, just think about it. Even if you're younger and you don't know any older people or whatever, you could be passing it around, or like your friends could have babies who don't have immune systems yet, or, you know, they're very like underdeveloped, or they're, what do you call it? I don't know. Babies, susceptible. Don't give them the flu.
They're still babies.
They're babies. Having completely hijacked this story.
The main way that you can tell whether it's the flu or just cold is they're saying that there's a fever that's over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and also that a cold typically comes on very slowly versus the flu typically hits you like a bus. So
that's good to know.
If you got either, you should stay home, drink fluids, and if you think you have the flu, you can go to a doctor in the first 48 hours so that you start showing symptoms, and get Tamiflu or an antiviral, because it's antibiotics does not work because it's a viral infection. Yes. And have a shorter cause because of that. So. Yeah. Get the flu shot, get Tamiflu.
Tamiflu is controversial, actually. I can't remember which one, but the CDC and the World Health Organization have never recently have not agreed on whether or not it's good. So caveat there. You know, I guess that...
Well, I've used it.
Yeah. Did it work for you?
Multiple times. And it worked for me. And if nothing else, it gave me a placebo effect.
Yeah, well, no. See, that is actually an underappreciated thing in medicine, I think. I think, honestly, to get to the more rational part of this question, or the meat of the question, you know, I know I've got all my caveats about, like, you can't tell the difference. Sometimes you can't. But if you're trying, you know, and you just want the, like, quick and dirty, like, how do you figure it out? It seems like the higher fever, aches and chills, more likely to be a flu. The more severe, more likely to be a flu. Stuffy nose, sore throat, more common with a cold. Like, milder things, more common with a cold. But I just, when people are like, I had the flu, I'm like, did you? You know, because you just don't know. Actually, it's more common. Yeah. It's more common for me to have the skepticism the other way. I've never had the flu. Really?
Yeah. So there are options. Mm-hmm. Do things, people.
Yeah. Also, important to know that if you want to try to use Tamiflu, you need to go to the doctor and be diagnosed or whatever within 48 hours. So.
Right.
Yeah. Then that's kind of counterintuitive, because I think I tend to wait until it's gone on long enough that I'm like, like, maybe I'm dying. Maybe I should go. And then by then it's too late. So.
Yeah. And they can't do anything for you.
Take your chances.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Robin. You met my need.
By just yelling from the beginning.
Yep. So our next, I saw it and I said, I'm saving that.
She's going to be pissed.
Our next news story comes from NBC News. It's millions left behind as diabetes drives surge in insulin demand. So yeah. This is a new report that looked at global diabetes epidemic that's fueling a record demand for insulin. but tens of millions will not be able to get the injections they need unless dramatic improvement in access and affordability is the conclusions of a new study. So it's since 1980, it's up from 5% to 9% of all adults worldwide have diabetes.
Is it type 1 or type 2?
Most of them have type 2, which is linked to obesity and lack of exercise, and is causes are spreading particularly rapidly in the developing world as people adopt more Western urban lifestyles.
AKA, they start eating the same garbage that we eat.
Right. So researchers say that the amount of insulin needed to effectively treat type 2 diabetes would rise more than 20% over the next 12 years. But insulin would be beyond the reach of nearly half of the 79 million type 2 diabetes predicted to be needed by 2030.
So is this like
2020 is just two years away, and like the one thing that I always like was super in the future, 2020 is not that far. It's like a year and 2 months, Robin. It's scary. Yeah.
It's basically tomorrow.
Yeah. So they published a report in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And the UN has a commitment to treat non-communicable diseases and ensure universal access to drugs for diabetes across the world, but it's super expensive. And it puts it out of the reach for a lot of people. And plus, there's also a lot of markups, and the supply chain is really strenuous. And there's a lot of middlemen, and that keeps marking up the prices. So there are really only three major suppliers worldwide.
Wow. I did not know that. Three in the whole world? Well, no wonder it's so expensive. They've got the market cornered.
They have three companies that dominate. So there might be more, but...
Sure.
But they dominate. So there is some caution to go along with this with the person that they interviewed. The estimates are, the forecasts are based on mathematical models. So,
yeah, okay, this is like, actually
at the trend amazing. That we're going, you know, we're going to run out of insulin for people who need it, and people who need it won't be able to afford it. So
yeah, and which is already the case. I mean, I've seen this stuff all over Facebook about people complaining about how much it costs. So this study is specific to type 2 diabetes, which is there's actually at least three types. Remember we talked about that last season? There's like a type that I can't even remember. Anyway, there's a type that's associated with some sort of organ damage, and that's how you get it. But anyway, the type 1 and type 2 are the most common. Type 1 is the more severe. This study, they did like a micro simulation, but they're only looking at type 2 diabetes. I'm not quite sure why. And they simulated...
I think because type 2 is caused by...
Lifestyle.
More by diet and lifestyle than type 1 and type 3, which are probably more unpredictable.
True. Although, to be fair, I think there is a genetic propensity as well. So we're not, if you have type 2 diabetes, we are not blaming you. Also, we would not do that. I like sugar as much as the next person.
I love sugar.
I know. It's kind of the best. It's kind of the best. And it's made me sad to realize, like, if you're a person who loves fat, well, fat has an actual, like, is a macronutrient that we need. It's like carbs, fat, protein. Those are the three. There's a need for calories, but there's no, like, as far as like refined sugar, if you never ate any, you'd be fine. And I'm like, oh man, like, why couldn't I be like a person who craves fat and salt, which are like things that at least you need some of it, you know? I just want like gummy worms. And it turns out that like, there's no real need for me to eat those. Although there's a period, which I think is 30 minutes, of like increased insulin resistance right after exercise. So theoretically, if I want to eat a ton of gummy worms, that would be my window. Just so you know.
Gotta be fast.
You gotta get in there. It's something about, I have no idea how it works. I just made a mental note at some point that I was like, okay. You also like for recovery purposes, you want to try to consume, they say. I got this off of from A few different sources. I think the Triathletes Training Bible says it. I think the Purple Patch Fitness podcast says it. And I think Sigma Nutrition podcast has said it, to try to get something between 30 and 60 minutes after. People are starting to say more 30 minutes after exercise. Anyway, that's not what this study is about. But what I think is interesting...
When has that ever stopped us?
When has that ever? Well, what I think is interesting about this study is that this is just like... based on cases that we know of now. So they're making a projection for how many people will have diabetes in 2030 based on how many people that we know of have diabetes now. But this is across 221 mm-hmm. countries, which is, I'm assuming, going to include many developing nations, where probably some people are not receiving any health care at all. Like, they just don't have access. So this is probably actually a conservative mm-hmm. estimate, right? Because if you're in a place where people don't have any health care, they're probably more likely to have issues, especially if there's food insecurity, and you know, and like, so they're not able to choose what to eat. So actually, I don't know if that's linked or not. I shouldn't say that. I think in our country sometimes food insecurity can be tied to diabetes because people are eating like fast foods, but I'm guessing that's not the case in developing nations. In any case, less healthcare, not necessarily a great thing. So I'm thinking that the results of this, if we had the actual numbers, could be much more profound. So the fact that it's notable, yeah, even with the current levels, is why I find this like surprising. And this study was just came out one day ago. It's on the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology Journal, and it's called Estimation of Global Insulin Use for Type 2 Diabetes 2018 through 30, a Microsimulation Analysis. I'm pretty sure everyone's running to Google that right now, and I will put a link in the show notes because I'm not a monster.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
All right. You ready for the next one?
Yep.
So our next one comes from Gizmodo, and it's CDC convenes task force to investigate rare illness paralyzing kids across the country. Hmm. So have you heard of AFM?
Yes.
So AFM is a mysterious polio-like disease that is paralyzing young children, and earlier this week, the agency announced that it would form a task force to better treat and confirm cases of acute flaccid
myelitis.
Myelitis, there we go.
Nailed it.
So it's a affects the nervous system, and it damages the area around the spinal cord that's made out of gray matter. The victims are almost always children whose symptoms like muscle weakness, difficulty speaking, swelling, and paralysis. For this year, there have been 108 confirmed cases across 29 states out of the 273 reports sent to the CDC. So they're still being investigated. And as of yet, there haven't been any deaths, but AMF can be fatal. So it's a task force looking at, like, what's causing it. So in 2014, cases started to be spotted more often since we eradicated the polio virus with the polio vaccination. In the U.S., it's incredibly rare to get polio, but in 2014, it got started to be spotted again. That year, there were 120 cases reported. Since then, AFM has followed a strange pattern, which seemingly jumps up to frequency every 2 years, which is, I think, is so, like, arbitrary because, like, mm-hmm. the way that we tell time is in no way influenced by, like, a virus. So,
right.
You know,
right.
Like, that we determine this is a year, but whatever. In 2015, there were only 22. In 2016, there were 150. In 2017, there were just 33. And then 2018, there were 108, at least. So it's just, jeez, it's continuous. So they're looking at what's causing it. There might be an enterovirus D68 that's a cousin to the polio virus, and that typically causes the common cold.
Yeah, so
not all the children have it in their spinal fluids, but and that's not the only virus that they have, but they don't really know what's causing it, and it looks like polio, but it's not. So it's just kind of weird.
Yeah, I think it's weird
because now they're doing a task force.
As one does. I think it's weird that it was caused by a virus that's a cousin of the polio virus that typically causes the common cold. This is where I feel like I wish we had a scientist to be like, is that normal? Because I didn't realize that those things were similar. Although I suppose that, like, as in so many things, like, a tiny change can result in a huge difference. Like, don't we have 99.9% of the same DNA as some sort of monkey or something? You know, this makes me, when I first saw this story, the reason I followed it was because I was expecting it to have something to do with lower rates of polio vaccination. Fun fact, mm-hmm. rate of childhood, like, of kids being on, like, the proper vaccination schedule in Oregon is currently 58%, as far as if I remember it correctly, which is just depressing. But that aside, yeah, I was really expecting this to have something to do with vaccination, and I don't see any mention of that. So it's like one of those things where I projected my own. I was like, oh, I was just waiting. I was like, here it comes. It's going to be like nobody wanted to, you know, vaccinate their kid and blah, blah, blah. And I still kind of wonder about it, but that is raw speculation on my side. So how scary. Also, it's sad because, you know, like, it's like, how do you find a virus in spinal fluid? Like, how do you test spinal fluid? I think Spinal Tap. And it's kind of sad to think about doing that to a bunch of little kids.
Yeah.
Could be wrong about that.
So, yeah. So, no, I think you're correct. I think that's the only way to get that.
AFM. So, like, your sister's a parent. Is she worried about this? Or is it something where people are just saying, like, eh, it's like a fluke?
I mean, it's 108 cases for the entire United States.
Yeah.
Right? So, it's a very small population. But I haven't talked to her about it, but, like, there are a million things as a parent that she has to worry about. I'm not sure that she's necessarily barring trouble for worried if her kid suddenly has paralysis. However, if her kid were to suddenly have paralysis,
she would become...
Then this would be a concern. Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's kind of... It's just, like, one more thing to worry about. Mm. Even if you get the vaccinations... There are weird diseases that make no sense and different things like that. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
Something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. You know.
You ready for the.
Yeah. No, I am. I was going to make a vaccine comment and I'm redacting my own comment. Let's move on.
Okay. So our last article comes from the National Public Radio, and it's, do wishes granted to very sick kids affect their health? So it's looking at a new study that comes from pediatric research that suggests that make-a-wishes it can have a positive impact. So researchers looked at nearly 1,000 children with serious illnesses who were treated at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. What up, Ohio? The children received wishes and the other half haven't. The children were granted substantially less likely to visit the emergency department or to have an unplanned hospital admission within 2 years as compared to children who hadn't received wishes. Researchers matched children's personal and disease characteristics in the study. So age, gender, type of illness, and the complexity were all taken into consideration for this study. So the hypothesis is that kids, when they come back, are more engaged with their families, medical providers, and are more likely to adhere to their treatment plan. So it's kind of looking at the idea of, hope and, drive that way. Mm-hmm. So it's not saying, like, you can wish or positive think your way out of an illness, but having a positive experience
helps,
can increase your hope and, you know, and put it into context and give you more of a drive and makes you, you know, let you be a kid again. So, yeah.
You know what I like about this study is it says, well, there's two paragraphs that I picked out as my favorite. They say a previous study tried to measure the effects of wish granting and found less distress fewer episodes of depression and reduced anxiety symptoms among children expecting a wish in the near future compared to those placed on a waiting list. What I think is interesting about this sentence is they're not even saying that the moment of the wish being granted or that day or however long it takes. It's when the kid knows that their wish is coming true, that period is when the positive effects start. So it's kind of like positive anticipation, which is making me smile just to say it. And then it says, this new study found more concrete differences, including cost savings. Now listen to this. The average cost of a wish is $10,682. Dang, what are these kids wishing for? Let's talk about that.
Well, but if it's
like a trip to Disney. Flights,
hotel cost, yeah. And then it's all of the...
Oh, the medical stuff.
All of the family goes too.
Yeah.
The medical stuff, yeah.
Probably they need like special... I just appreciate, you know, that the kids aren't like, I wish for like their favorite meal. They're like, I want to charter a jet. I want to fly to Abu Dhabi. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I appreciate that they're thinking big. Anyway, the average cost is $10,682, but multiple unplanned hospitalizations cost more. The study found that twice as many wish recipients had reduced health costs compared with people who didn't receive them. The problem is that health insurance companies, you know, like the money goes to different places, even though there's a global savings.
Yeah. So there are 496 children who received wishes and 496 who did not, of the same approximate age, gender, disease category, and disease complexity. The distribution of private insurance, no insurance, and Medicare was also similar in both groups.
Hmm. You know what? I wonder about the ethics of this study, though. I mean, I guess not giving a kid a wish isn't it's not like denying them medical treatment, but it seems a little bit cruel. I mean, maybe they picked kids who retrospectively hadn't received a wish, but I wonder.
No, I think they just looked at the health of children and didn't have like a control group.
Yeah.
They just like picked the control group.
Oh, you're right.
Based on those who had not.
Yeah, you're right. It says
because there's no...
Yeah, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It says the study is observational. So there is that. Yes. So that kind of makes the findings less generalizable because it's, you know... But, okay, I am somewhat relieved to know that they weren't like, okay, all these kids are, like, terminally ill. Like, you're going to go to Disney World and you're not, like... God, can you imagine how hard it is, if you're the Make-A-Wish Foundation, how hard it is to pick? Because you have to say no to some kids, right?
Right.
Okay. That's rough. That is rough. Man. I would like to see... the wishes that they ask for. There's a little sidebar in the story about a 6-year-old boy whose wish was to be a garbage collector for a day. That is a great wish. He had cystic fibrosis, yeah. And he wanted to wear the uniform and ride on the garbage truck. You know, I get it. I've often wondered about riding on the back of one of those.
Mm-hmm. So Make-A-Wish that has 60 U.S. chapters has granted more than 300,000 wishes since 1980. The organization granted approximately 15,400 wishes last year. Still estimate 27,000 children are diagnosed annually with illness that qualifies them. So there's a huge gap.
Wow. And so I guess we should do this now. If you would like to support Make-A-Wish, their website is wish.org. Pretty good, huh? Wish.org? I wonder how much they had to pay for that URL. Probably a lot.
I don't know. They probably locked... I don't know. They've been around since the 80s, so they probably locked that shit down.
Well, yeah, maybe they did. Okay. Anyway, we haven't vetted that nonprofit, but I'm touched. Laura's touched, and she's, you know, that's tough to do. So, wish.org, no, there you go.
I mean, when I worked for Disney, there were children who had Make-A-Wish, and a part of our training was that children who had, like, a piece of paper for their disability or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a disability access pass. It's something new now. But if it had a green star, that meant they went directly to the front of the line. They bypassed everything, and that you did everything. We were instructed to do everything to make their day a little bit better. And that was just the general frontline people of doing it. So Disney takes their Make-A-Wish children very seriously. So,
That's so sweet. Because I bet a lot of kids want to go to Disney.
Only interaction with, I know a lot of children also WWE, the wrestling. I know there are a lot of Make-A-Wish kids with that too.
Like WWE?
So, yeah.
Yeah. Kids want to be wrestlers? I didn't know that. Oh, I guess they watch it on...
They want to be a wrestler. You know, they want to beat whatever disease they have. You know, they want to be big and strong, like, you know, those people. And, you know, WWE, for as many, like, villains that they have scripted, they also have a lot of heroes. So I think...
Yeah.
It's tied to that, too.
I remember that one with the little boy who wanted to be Batman and he went to the White House. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That one got a lot of press.
He is, Batboy is in remission. I saw
that. Oh, he is? Oh, that's cute. Okay, so I looked this up. To be eligible for a wish from Make-A-Wish, a child must be between the ages of 2.5 and 18 at the time of referral, have a life-threatening medical condition that will be verified by their physician. So pretty broad.
So it's not, it's very broad, and it doesn't have to be terminal. It just has to be life-threatening.
Okay. That seems fair.
So I thought that was a good study of kind of looking at hope.
Yes. Okay, look, I also looked up most requested wishes because I'm me and I must know. Here you go. They categorize them as wishing to go places, be things, meet people, or have things. I want a meta-analysis of what kids have asked for. Said some wish kids, they're saying theme parks, exotic beaches, cruises, or seeing something for the first time like snow, attending a major sporting event or concert. Or they want to role play a job for a day. Firefighter, police officer, and model is common. Wanting to meet a favorite athlete, musician, TV personality, etc. Or they may wish for a gift like a computer, a treehouse, a shopping spree. Man, okay, I want this to be like in the same way that the CDC breaks down causes of death every year and they're like number one, number two, and it's like very specific. I would love to see like a specific. Because I bet some of them are funny, you know, because some of them are little kids. And I bet it'd just be funny to see, like, what percent of kids want to be a garbage collector? Or, like, what are they wishing for? It was, like, that study of kids. There was a pediatric oncologist who, like, asked all of his patients for a year or something, like, the best and worst things about having cancer. And, like, ice cream was one of the most common things. They're, like, best thing about having cancer is I get tons and tons of ice cream, you know. And it's just funny to see what their little kid... What their little kid selves come up with. Aw.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Laura, guess what time it is?
Time is it?
It's time for my thing that I'm obsessed with this week.
So what is your current medical fascination?
Thanks for asking. I've been holding on to this one for like 6 days. So, you know how there was all the fires in California?
Yes.
So, there's all these issues where we don't know the exact effects of breathing in particulate matter. We know it's bad. We know that it can probably cause a lot of things, or I guess we hypothesize that it could cause a lot of things, but we don't have like a ton of data. But California has been having a series of, as everyone I'm sure knows, record-setting fires. And so a lot of people are wearing these like filtration masks. And so I actually had already done a little research into filtration masks, and I did a little more research just trying to understand. You know, I'm just kind of wondering, like, how much does that help? Blah, 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 blah. And, like, you know, it really depends on who you ask. But the short story is that helps me was to understand that these things can filter out smells, they can filter out stuff, like particles, and they can filter out, like, viruses, bacteria, which I guess is technically also stuff. But those are, like, three different types of things. And as you would guess, like, usually the more complicated masks are better. Like, those little ones that people wear at the hospital would not be good for filtering out, like, particulate matter. So if you're dealing with, like, particulate matter, you want something with, like, an N95. I don't know. Is that the name of the valve or the... what's it called? I'm forgetting the word. So, N95. Do you know, Laura? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like those ones with the little thing on them, like a little valve almost. I guess they just call them an N95 respirator. And the idea is that it filters at least 95% of airborne particles. So, but just because something is an N95 does not necessarily mean that it's going to filter out viruses. So some people are, like, immunocompromised, and you would want, like, there's military grade filtration technology that would filter out more. If anyone's, like, super interested in this, there's a mask called the Cambridge mask that I found online that looks like one of the better ones. So they have, like, that will just basically filter out more and will filter out viruses and stuff. But what I think the important takeaway is that there's it's more complex than people think. And, like, so just wrapping a scarf around your face, not good. Wearing the thing like your doctor wears or your dental hygienist wears, the little paper thing, not great. Those ones that you get, like 3M makes them. You can buy a little paper mask. Usually it has the yellow headband strap at the hardware store. Those are better, but a lot of it depends on, like, how much it seals over your face too. So if you get a mask but it doesn't fit well, then all the air just comes in anyway. And I think that the valves they put on there are actually mainly for comfort. Like, it helps, like, the carbon dioxide get out, because otherwise it gets kind of hot, and I can tell you from experience, kind of icky after a while. So I've been, like, I don't feel like I've really figured it out all the way, but I know that, like, there can be carbon filters for, like, smells and stuff, which, you know, might be nice, but not super necessary. But I was just interested because I've been seeing people on social media, like, wearing all sorts of different masks, and I'm like, ugh. Or you see someone wearing a mask and it has two straps and they only have one strap on, and I'm like, no, that's not good either. Like, it really needs, honestly, probably needs to be, like, uncomfortably on you. Like, if you're adjusting it to make it more comfortable, chances are it's not working as well. Because it has to be like basically forming a seal around your nose and mouth, and you want all the air to go through the mask. So I've just been a little concerned when I see people doing other things. Like, I don't want to judge them. Like, and the information's not out there yet. So we have to, like, make our own decisions about, like, when do you feel like it's safe enough to go outside and all this stuff. But Laura, I bet you don't even own a mask, right? Don't need a mask. You don't have to worry about this.
I don't. I live in Ohio, so no forest fires here.
Well, this is, like, the downside of...
Yet.
Of crabs, which did not, thankfully, arrive during the podcast, because I was like, what am I going to do if the crabs have to be... You know what? Could I put them in a cooler?
Probably.
That could work, because, like, they can't lift the lid off a cooler. Maybe if they keep...
I don't know, they're tricky tricksters.
I could tape it. Are they going to suffocate in there? Not for, like, an hour, though. I just need to... The situation is, I just need to be able to leave for, like... And I guess it's going to be an hour and a half. And then come back. And then...
Okay, I think you'll be okay.
I feel kind of scared. I feel kind of scared.
Oh. Well, if they're dead, don't eat them when you get back. That's enough bad patienting for 1 week, Robin.
All right, great. Well, just leave me alone with my crab situation. That's fine. We want to say a special thanks to our theme song composer, Evan Schaefer. You can check out his music at soundcloud.com/Evan Schaefer. You can connect with us on Twitter at The Bad Patient, online at thebadpatient.com, and through email by emailing hello@thebadpatient.com. We hope that you will like, share, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your media. Until next time, we are Bad Patient.
Malpractice makes perfect.